from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Isabel Duran in for Dave Iverson. Federal funding for clean technologies reached an all-time high in 2009, but a new study finds that money will dry up over the next 2 years. As a result, the report predicts more clean tech companies are likely to go bankrupt or be consolidated. We talked to the authors of the report this hour. What impact is this funding uncertainty having on innovation? And what will it mean for green jobs in the Bay Area? That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Isabel Duran in today for Dave Iverson. At a time when the U.S. is struggling to get back on its economic feet, when job growth waxes and wanes, one of the few sectors that grew 21st century jobs is in danger as federal funding is about to dry up. One of the authors of a new report on clean tech beyond boom and bust, putting clean tech on a path to subsidy independence, was quoted in a Los Angeles Times article saying, "We're falling off the cliff, a victim of budget deficit politics and energy policy backlash." Federal stimulus money, tax credits, and billion-dollar investments moved this industry from a sideshow to a real global industry, according to Time magazine. The Clean Tech Report found annual financial support for clean energy sectors is poised to decline by 75% from its 2009 high of $44.3 billion to $11 billion. Putting, says the report, America's clean energy policy at the crossroad. The authors say there is hope, but will take both political will and public engagement. Joining us are two co-authors of the report, Mark Muro, a senior fellow and policy director for the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., Jesse Jenkins, director of energy and climate policy at the Breakthrough Institute in Oakland, and Joseph Desmond, former chairman of the California Energy Commission and senior vice president of government affairs and communications for Bright Source Energy, a developer of utility-scale solar power plants in Oakland. Good morning, Mr. Muro. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
My first question to you, I think, just to clarify for the public, is there a difference between clean tech and green tech?
Absolutely. There's sometimes confusion. Clean tech to us is a narrower group of high technology, usually fast growth, innovation oriented industries, often involved in renewable energy, energy efficiency, and so on. These are your classic, sexy, high-flying solar, photovoltaic, solar, wind, fuel cell, smart grid sorts of industries. And I would say that the Bay Area is, one of the capitals in the world for this cluster. Green economy is a broader set of environmentally oriented, sometimes conservation or remediation oriented industries that includes clean tech, but it's much broader and includes things like even mass transit or waste hauling, things that have an undeniable positive impact on the environment but are not oriented towards these renewable and energy areas.
But if clean tech is impacted, as you say, could this have a negative effect on green tech?
Well, certainly. I mean, these are important portions of a broader economy. These are in some ways a crucial part of the whole narrative of moving towards a cleaner, more environmentally beneficial economy. So there's certainly a relationship. I will note, clean tech is a relatively small but especially important innovation-oriented subset.
Okay, then let's get to the report itself. Is clean tech really falling off a cliff?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's important to have the cliff is that of really a massive wind down of a historically unusual pulse of federal policy support, ranging from tax programs to direct subsidies to loan guarantees and so on. Undeniably, there's a massive reset before us. You know, our work was to look broadly beyond the individual melodramas of particular industries, individual tax credits and particular programs, and look broadly. We looked at 92 programs that in some way offer critical policy or financial support to clean tech. We found 61 out of 92 of these programs are have a preset expiration dates and are essentially going away by the end of 2014. So that's two-thirds of the programs that were in place in 2009 will have a expiration and need to be re-expired. 75% dollar pullback from the 2009 high to 2014. We're talking about pullback from $44 billion to $11 billion. And right this year is, you know, right in the middle of that, a 50% cut. So potentially absent congressional action. So we're talking about, you know, industries that to varying degrees rely on federal policy and financial support as they compete with other mature technologies and fossil fuel solutions are going to be seeing a massive change in the policy environment. So that funding is undeniably reaching a cliff, and the question is whether these industries fall over with that withdrawal of that finance. We think an abrupt, immediate termination would lead to substantial tumult. It's going to be a tough pathway otherwise, but as we'll discuss, I think there are ways to manage this transition.
So how much are fiscal conservatives in Washington driving the decisions on whether to re-up or increase any kind of federal funding and or policy, and how much did the Solyndra debacle give them a cudgel to start cutting? And maybe you want to explain the Solyndra debacle.
Well, sure. I mean, it's undeniable that, you know, this pre-scheduled set of expirations comes at a very difficult time. And I'll just make the, you know, to reiterate, many of these programs have scheduled expirations or sunsets. They're temporary programs that have this pre-scheduled renewal juncture. The unfortunate thing is that it comes at a time of substantial green backlash, difficult, to say the least, partisan debates in this town in which I sit, and a absolutely grinding fiscal circumstance that is, you know, real and is going to require, you know, massive belt tightening in Washington. The Solyndra instance, obviously, you know, chronicled ad nauseum, and I'm sure intensely in your region, was, you know, the bankruptcy of a company that received a large loan guarantee from the Department of Energy's Loan Guarantee Program, which has, you know, been an important investor in large-scale scale-up of some technologies at a project level. This bankruptcy, you know, fueled a sense of, you know, that the government was dabbling clumsily in industrial policy. And while it might seek to invest to construct new industries, it was clumsily doing that. This fed into lots of, you know, ideological narratives and has made things even more difficult. Meanwhile, we have this wide range of, you know, programs of all sorts that at minimum are going to need to be revisited, reassessed, and in our view, hopefully redesigned so that you're seeing, you know, a managed withdrawal of support over a longer time period than an abrupt termination. But you're absolutely right that, you know, there are there is a serious constituency in Washington advocating for absolute immediate cold turkey and termination of all of these programs.
You know, subsidies through the German governments helped build their success in this sector, and they're now talking about serious cuts. What signals does that send both to Washington and to the global sector around this issue?
Well, the circumstances are often different around the world, given particular the nature of the particular policies. But there's certainly a shared economic retrenchment going on and extreme budget pressure in country after country. At the same time, I think the direction is certainly likely shared, but I think countries will adopt varied responses to and ways of managing austerity here. And our point is that there are ways to manage austerity here to, in fact, redesign these programs so they're, in fact, better and more useful for supporting the emergence of these dynamic new industries.
Thanks, Mark Muro. We'll get back to you in a minute. Let's turn to Jesse Jenkins. He's the Director of Energy and Climate Policy of the Breakthrough Institute in Oakland and was the project director on this report. Jesse Jenkins, there was a lot of breakthrough success, particularly around solar. You've seen the price of it going down, and a lot of people are adapting it, and people were getting subsidies from PG&E and others to do different things. What is your fear now? It took you several years to accumulate data through this report?
It took us several months. We worked on
about six months.
To comb through a lot of budget documents and piece together what is probably the most comprehensive look at federal support for the clean energy sectors at large. A number of different sectors, and as Mark mentioned, about 92 different programs. So there's really a variety of support programs in place, and getting a comprehensive look at the current funding and also the direction going forward was a good research task, but one we think is really valuable to ground a really realistic discussion about where we're going now.
And what were the highs in the industry, and how threatened are they now?
Well, I think what we're seeing are sort of growing pains for an industry that is in many ways succeeding. I think the challenges that solar or wind or other clean energy technologies face now are as much a sign of their growing success than they are mounting failure, which is sort of the narrative that you might take away from the Solyndra, politicized Solyndra discussions. The price of solar panels, the panels themselves fell about 60% in 2011 alone. That resulted in a pretty significant decline in the total installed cost of solar systems once you include labor and the racks and mounting, the inverters and things you need to complete a solar installation. And the price of wind turbines has fallen about 25%, 27% over the last few years. So the turbines that are going into projects now that'll come online in 2012 and 2013 are better and cheaper than they were in the last few years. And part of what's driving that is the steady support that these industries have received from the federal government and from certain state governments like California over the last several years. So they've helped these industries mature and really, I think, kickstart from being fairly infant industries to being sort of adolescent industries. And the challenge we face now is how do we get them from adolescence to full adulthood?
Is that the inflection point you're talking about?
That's exactly right. We're at this key inflection point both in the industry's growth and in the direction of federal funding. We're at a point where these technologies are becoming more significant contributors to our energy system, either in California or in the country. That's increasing the cost of the subsidies and policies that are helping support them, because as they grow, these technologies grow, the tax impact also grows. So that's sort of one of the growing pains challenges we have is how to reduce the per unit subsidy, the per kilowatt hour or per watt subsidies we're providing as these industries scale up and grow. We can talk about later. California actually has some good models in place that I think exhibit that those characteristics that would be great for federal policymakers to look at as models. But we also have the other challenge, which is intensifying competition in these markets. And this is what really claimed Solyndra as the price of
which
solar
we should
panels,
remind everybody was in Fremont.
That's right. Is manufactured their panels in Fremont, California, across the bay from us here. And they this is a very fast-growing industry that attracted a lot of competition from other firms in the United States and abroad in China and Germany and elsewhere. Again, that's a sign of success. This is a market opportunity that global competition is becoming increasingly fierce. So we think, our perspective now is at this inflection point, the challenge, both of those challenges, intensified competition and the rising cost of subsidies to support industry growth, can only be tackled by a renewed commitment to driving innovation and cost reductions in these technologies. The U.S.-based firms have to outcompete firms in China for cost and performance. Innovation is going to be key to doing that. And they have to reduce the cost of these technologies so that we can phase down and phase out over time the subsidies that were necessary to kickstart these industries' growth. Again, innovation is the key to doing that.
So that's the positive side of the picture. But let's turn over to Joseph Desmond. He is the Senior Vice President of Government Affairs and Communications for BrightSource Energy. This is a developer of utility-scale solar power plants and recently canceled its IPO, citing adverse market conditions. And you were former chairman of the California Energy Commission, so I think you were watching boom and bust as well from both seats that you sit at.
Yeah, that's correct. I had an opportunity to see this from a couple different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
But with respect to the IPO withdrawal, that was really a function of where the market was at the time that we were out and looking at some.
And this was when?
This was about a week ago.
About
a week ago. So, I mean, the market had enjoyed really several months of strong growth. And at the time we went out, it was looking pretty good. But then in the very short period leading up to when we expected to have the IPO, we saw the volatility index was up 33%. The Dow Jones and the S&P had fallen 2.4%. NASDAQ Clean Edge was down 6.6%. And so all of these factors come to where you have to make a decision. Now, the good news is we're able to make that withdrawal from a position of strength. And by that, I mean we have very strong investors. We have long-term contracts deliver a series of another 2.4 gigawatts of power. There are other financing options to get the projects constructed. So it was in terms of the timing and IPO, it just didn't make some sense, so we simply withdrew. But we're still moving full steam ahead on the construction of all of our projects.
A couple of things. Did the Solyndra debacle have anything to do with perhaps the reluctance in the marketplace?
It's hard to say that one incident had anything to do. I think it's more to what Jesse's pointing out is the drop in prices in the solar sector and the impact in some of the companies. But I'll draw the distinction here is that when we talk about solar, most of that discussion focuses on something called solar PV or solar photovoltaics. What BrightSource does is actually a little bit different. We use solar thermal technology. So we use a field of mirrors where we concentrate the sun's energy onto a central boiler to create high pressure, high temperature steam. And in turn, that steam is used to turn a turbine to generate electricity. We can also use that steam to store energy to continue to produce electricity at night, even when the sun goes down. So very different technologies, but it's hard to get people initially to understand the difference. We made a lot of progress there, but as I said, they have different attributes that complement, but they are very different technologies. So I wouldn't say Solyndra was a significant factor.
But it certainly gives the whole industry a black mark. I mean, that's what people think of the negative side of it.
Unfortunately, that
the
is
impression.
The case.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we go to the next question, I just want to tell the listeners we're discussing a new report on diminishing funding for clean tech and the impact that it will have on the industry. Our guests include co-authors of the report, Jesse Jenkins from the Breakthrough Institute in Oakland, Mark Muro from the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., as well as Joseph Desmond, whom you just heard from BrightSource, a clean tech company. And you can find a link to the report on our website, kqed.org/forum. Are you talking about the need to move the investment from the feds to private? And are you seeing enough of that? Let's look at this story that just came out yesterday on SF Gate. And it refers to Solyndra's spectacular collapse, but it is coming from the California – it's the California Green Innovation Index from a public policy group called Next10, and they track the green economy's health. And they're saying California's clean tech industry continues to thrive, soaking up more venture capital in 2011 than it did before the recession. Joe, so, does that sound about right to you? And
yes,
that what's giving you hope?
It doesn't surprise me. So let's look at a project example that's working and working well. And many of the jobs figures that have come out don't necessarily capture the things that people are already working on. So Ivanpah is a project where we're providing our technology. NRG is an investor in that. Google is an investor in that. That is a project that will be delivering 370 megawatts of power into the system. It is currently employing over 1,400 highly skilled workers out there, another 250 service workers as well, and is on track, on schedule, on budget, and is a loan recipient from the DOE Loan Guarantee Program.
It's in the Mojave Desert, is it?
It is in the Mojave Desert, just outside of Las Vegas, just not too far. And the distinction and the difference between the Solyndra, which is a loan based on an expectation to compete in the market, is that this is about a project finance. That project has long-term contracts with utilities, very creditworthy utilities, who will take the output over a period of 20 years. And so what you're able to do here is the purpose of the loan guarantee was to allow commercialization of innovative technology. So coming out of the lab and the R&D support and then demonstrated at scale. But the long-term view and long-term expectation is that we don't need loan guarantees. But what is important is more efficient tax policy and incentives that I think the report does a great job of highlighting where the discussion needs to focus on. So there's money willing to be invested out there on clean tech projects, whether it's in Ivanpah or it's others, but the incentives and the tax really have to be aligned appropriately.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges facing
the industry right now is, despite all the progress made, and there has been a remarkable amount of progress developing new technologies, improving the price of existing technologies. Natural gas has become remarkably cheap in the United States, and it's sort of moved the goalposts on clean energy sources. So from 2008 highs of about $13 per million British thermal units, which is the arcane measurement that they use to measure units of natural gas, prices have fallen from $13 to under $2.50, $2.50. So this is a dramatic decrease. And that's moved the goalposts for wind and for central station solar, like BrightSource is working on, and to a lesser degree for rooftop solar, which competes less directly with natural gas since it's more competing with retail electricity rates. So further innovation is required, and additional continued support from state and federal policymakers is going to be key to helping these industries continue to close that cost gap between well-entrenched and well-developed fossil energy sources and emerging clean energy technologies. Our report counsels, instead of sort of pulling back dramatically right now, which is sort of the glide path we're on, we really need a managed approach that over the next several years, through sort of the end of the decade for some technologies, provides a steady drawdown in the amount of federal support provided per megawatt or per kilowatt hour, and allows these technologies the time and support and really demands from them that they continue to drive down the price and improve the performance of their products to compete on price with fossil fuels.
So we've been talking about survival of the company, but we're also talking about, and the president was pushing green and clean tech because he wanted jobs to be created. And we've seen waxes and wanes in the job. We're going to be talking to somebody in that arena next. We're going to continue our conversation about clean tech and green jobs after a short break. If you'd like to join the discussion, call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Isabel Duran, sitting in for Dave Iverson, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Isabel Duran in for Dave Iverson. We're discussing a new report on financing for clean tech and the future of the green economy. Let's hear from Fred Lucero. He's actually the program manager of the Richmond Build Academy, a construction skills and green job training program. Good morning, Fred. Are you with us there?
Yes, I am. Good morning to you.
Good, thanks. What has been the experience for your program, which is obviously a major attempt to put people to work?
Our experience has been a very positive one when it comes to retraining individuals and then placing them in the job market. And we have seen firsthand the benefits of that, of retraining somebody who's either looking for a new career, someone who has paid their debt to society and want to get back into the workforce, retraining them into an industry that they would have never been exposed to prior to coming to Richmond Build, and having taken a solar class or an energy efficiency class or a green construction class, the solar light or the incandescent, you know, the light bulb goes on and they get the interest sparks and they want to pursue this as a career. So we've seen a very positive outcome of retraining individuals.
Can you give me a profile of those folks that you're training? Are they young, just out of high school, or are they engineers looking for a new start? What does that worker bee look like?
It's a cross section of individuals. It's someone who's 18 and up, right out of high school, to somebody who maybe have been laid off from a white collar job, or somebody who was laid off from a blue collar job. You know, a single mother, somebody who was, you know, paid their debt to society, like I said, and they've come back into the workforce. They want to be retrained and go to work. Someone who's maybe a stay-at-home mother or father, and again, they want to come back into the workforce. We get a cross-section of people at Richmond Build.
Is Richmond Build getting a steady investment of dollars, or are you seeing an up and down so that you can train just a few people, or you can continue to train large numbers?
Well, our average class size is about 30 people, and we're grant funded, so we're seeing a definite decline in the grants coming out from the federal government and from the state as well. But the ones that do come out, that we feel we'll do well, and we always apply for. But we also, you know, we have a public-private partnership with local businesses, and that invest into Richmond Build, that become corporate sponsors. So we really kind of we're diverse in who we go after as far as funding to keep our program going. In fact, Monday is our fifth anniversary. We'll mark 5 years of Richmond Build. So,
how concerned are you about the cuts, the potential upcoming cuts from the feds?
We're concerned. It's always a concern. Funding is always a concern for us. You know, we don't have the luxury of having a nice, healthy budget. We're always singing and dancing for our food, which keeps us always hungry and keeps us moving and for the next grant. But it's always funding is always a concern for us. It's something that we're always that's my director's job, is to go after funding. My job is to make sure that we meet the placements and the numbers required by our grants. But we're always looking, you know, for new funding.
So in terms of your trainees, can you say you've had 100% placement?
In our first year, we had about a 90-95% placement rate. You know, the city of Richmond has a local employment ordinance, and so we hold contractors that come and do work into the city, we hold them to that. Lately, it's been about 70-75%, and that's just with the downturn in the economy. But we're seeing some things starting to pick up a little bit.
Great. Thanks, Fred Lucero from Richmond Build Academy. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're interested in a job in this sector, and you have some thoughts to share with us, you can call 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I want to go back to Washington and Mark Muro at the Brookings Institute. Mark, we had talked earlier about this being a real important idea for President Obama, who's been talking about green and clean tech and trying to promote this industry. What does this this fiscal conservatism imply for him in Washington?
Well, a couple things, and this is all really interesting. I mean, you know, I think the excitement and the intuition of, you know, a massive transformation of the economy through green and clean development, through the boom years and through the election campaign, actually, you know, placed, I think, you know, inordinate hopes and exaggerated expectations of immediate job creation on this whole industry. You know, we produced you know, really the first ever metro by metro, you know, region by region, city by city, county by county analysis of the size and growth dynamics of green and clean last year. And, you know, I think there was some consternation around some of the results. But, you know, it does turn out this the green economy and especially clean tech has been a growth economy, but the numbers are, have been far smaller than expected. And so, and it simply owes, I think, that to the a lack of detailed analysis of what these jobs and economies are. They're often quite efficient. In clean tech, you simply don't need a huge number of bodies. Jobs are probably not the right metric for judging success, which ought to be about around innovation outcomes, exports, you know, contributions to technology growth and other things like that. So, you know, in, there's clearly, you know, exaggerated expectations. And meanwhile, now we're heading into a very difficult period in which, you know, job creation will be an even less appropriate metric of what can still be success. I mean, my view is that these are successful industries. The intuition is right about their importance and transformative power. These are major sites of innovation, technology development, and they're major participants in what's going to be a major growth of investment in the country, in the world. So,
Mark Muro, yeah. let me read something that just came in from one of our listeners through email, who certainly agrees with you. He says clean energy would certainly be good for the environment. I doubt it will do much for growing jobs in the long run. Just as cell phones are wiping out landline phones and e-books are wiping out physical bookstores, it seems reasonable to assume that job growth in clean industry will be offset to a large degree by job losses in dirty energy, that is the oil and coal industries. And I saw Jesse Jenkins, you were jumping up and down. Did you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit more positive than the email comment in the long term, and that's because global demand for energy is growing quite dramatically. So whereas, you know, we may have through energy efficiency measures and others, we sort of held electricity growth pretty constant or pretty steady here in California. We're sort of saturated with our you know, all of our energy needs. We have modern electricity all around us every day. The picture for most of the world, the vast majority of the world's population, is one where energy demand is growing rapidly, where 1.5 billion people have no access to electricity at all worldwide. And about a fifth of the global population is trapped in what some are calling energy poverty, sort of a critical lack of access to modern energy sources. And of course, energy is key to fueling the development of emerging economies. So there is a huge hunger for new energy sources. I think there's a huge hunger for cleaner energy sources. If you just take a look at the air in Beijing or Shanghai on any day, you know, China and other emerging economies recognize that coal may have kickstarted their growth, but it's not a long-term route to power their economic future. And so there's a huge market out there in the long term. And I think, as Mark said, the expectations for job growth in the short term, I think we're overly optimistic. These are small industries that are growing. The clean tech sectors that we look at in this report grew 12% from 2007 to 2010, even during the height of the Great Recession. Exactly.
Yeah.
So there is positive trends here, but the numbers are fairly small. That was 70,000 additional jobs. So it's not millions. The long-term potential, though, is in the multi-trillions. You know, the global energy industry today is a $1.5-2 trillion industry, and it's going to grow quite dramatically. It could double by mid-century. So there's a huge opportunity for the United States to take a leadership role in developing these technologies. If we can make them cost competitive with fossil fuels and with international competitors in the clean tech space, there's a huge export opportunity here that'll have great benefits to the U.S. economy. But it's going to be a longer term effort, and we need to sort of stay the course and have measured expectations as to what the next few years hold.
That's the important word, measured expectations. Let's go to the phone and talk to Chris from Oakland. He says he uses Solyndra cells. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. My name's Chris. I'm a board member of the AC Transit. We've got about $6 million in Solyndra cells purchased with a federal grant, and they work great. What Solyndra didn't count on was that the Chinese were going to invest $30 billion in cash and God knows how much in land and water to compete with them. But we use the Solyndra cell power to convert water into hydrogen, which we then use in our fleet of 12 hydrogen fuel cell powered buses. And that's another example of clean tech. Those buses have dropped in price by a third. The last model was $3.6 million. The new ones are $2.5 million. But that's still a whole lot more than a diesel bus, which is about $500,000. But our clean tech buses were built in quantity 16. They're essentially hand-built. And we need continuing federal support to get the quantities up so that mass production can drive the price down.
You also probably, Chris, have to convince your local public and your local governments that the investments are wise.
The local public and local government loves it.
Okay.
We get huge support in terms of tax measures that we've put on and use the clean tech as a selling point. We are training our own employees to do it. I don't think we're adding a lot, but the main selling point is clean and quiet.
Thanks, Chris. Let's listen to Joseph Desmond. He was nodding his head there, liking what he hears.
Well, Chris raises a couple of interesting points. I think number one is the reference to the Chinese government support sort of brings us back to the point of what this report is about, is what is the long-term view for federal, state and federal support for tax incentives or policies to encourage clean investment. So this year, in fact, it's a little bit of good news that the U.S. clean tech sector invested about $48.6 billion, taking over China, which invested about $45.6 billion. So, but as Jesse's saying, that a lot of that's about to expire. If you go back in time to give some context to this about the decisions our grandparents made, the last 60 years, just looking at federal incentives for oil, natural gas, and coal, they totaled $594 billion. Really, in fact, over the last 60 years, 70% of all federal incentives, tax credits, incentives, programs, government spending, were for fossil fuels. And so renewables have a very small share of that. You could even look and say the fossil fuels are five times higher in the first 15 years compared to the renewables. So the question is, what are the appropriate policies? How can we ensure that the taxpayers' dollars are being spent efficiently? And there's a number of good examples that we can point to. But to the point of inflection, we talked about jobs. 2010 was a watershed year from the perspective that solar jobs in the solar industry surpassed jobs in the coal industry. There's 100,000 and compared to coal of a high in 2006 is I think about 82,000. So we're seeing a change in that economy. What do we need? The most important thing, and I say this from being on both sides of a regulator and thinking about it, is regulatory certainty. If you think about how long it takes to build this infrastructure, a transmission line might take 10 to 15 years to plan and construct. A generator is going to take years to permit, 1 to 3 years, and then 1 to 3 years to build. And so these are long lead time items, and it's not like an iPhone that comes out with a new model every year. We're talking about generations of technology that sometimes take a decade or more before you see these improvements. So when the report talks about temporary incentives, temporary in the energy might mean decades as opposed to, say, 1 or 2 years. And you've got to take that long-term view when you're talking about setting the United States on a path to long-term competitiveness.
We are an impatient country, right? Let me give out the phone number again, 866-733-6786. If you have a comment, let me read this from Mike because it goes right there to your point. Is there any political chance of putting a floor on fossil fuel prices? It seems to me that uncertainty about future market prices is a big deterrent to investment in alternatives. If the floor was a bit below current prices, could that possibly float? I fear not, but it seemed worth asking. Any response to that, Jesse?
This is an interesting concept, one that I've heard circulated in policy discussions. Usually in the context of oil prices, since oil price volatility is gone up and down as economies grow and demand grows, and then the recessions hit, price falls as demand falls. I mean, I think it's a there's some policy merits to that. The politics, particularly in an election year, of saying that we're going to make sure that your electricity, your energy doesn't fall any cheaper than it is now is, I think, a difficult sell. I think what would be a stronger route to go is to focus on making clean energy cheaper. On driving the improvements in technology costs that we have seen historically. And if we have the right policies in place and the right effort from industry can see going forward, you know, we heard about the falling price of fuel cells. We hear about the falling price of solar panels. These technologies are coming down in price as the price of oil goes up. I think actually the story of natural gas, which has come down in price dramatically, is actually quite telling. And it gets to the point that Joe just raised about historic investments that the federal government has made in fossil fuel sectors. Shale gas extraction technology, the ability to get oil out of permeable shale rock to get natural gas out of shale rock is a relatively new technology that really only became cost competitive around 2005, 2006. And it's revolutionized the North American natural gas market. As I said, prices fell from $13 down to $2.50 per million British thermal units. That's a huge change. But what unlocked that was both private sector ingenuity and over 25 years of federal government investment in the development of those technologies. We partnered on the development of the horizontal drilling, on microseismic imaging technologies to let engineers see under the ground and find out how to design the fractures they were going to make to get shale out rock to yield the gas that was in it. And we had 22 years of an unconventional gas tax credit, which helped make that technology profitable for people to tinker around with and explore and develop while it was still more expensive than conventional natural gas. So we have a playing field that's tilted in fossil fuels favor. It's been tilted by decades of investment from the federal government in the development of those technologies. What's going to be key to overcoming that going forward and making clean energy cheaper is the same kind of investment in innovation, in product development, and encouragement of new technological innovations that can close the cost gap that is here now between clean energy and fossil fuels.
Bonnie in Berkeley has been very patiently waiting, so let's take a call from her. Bonnie?
What occurs to me from what you've just said and, you know, what I read and the media and so forth is that there is perhaps a political will to allow solar to perhaps fade into the background in favor of natural gas. In other words, I look at the tariffs that are being applied to Chinese solar, and the net effect in this country, of course, looks like it's helping the solar industry, but in fact, it's making solar installation on the ground more costly and perhaps less viable. So I'm just suggesting that maybe there is a political component here that's trying to give natural gas a more competitive place in the future energy supply world.
Let me go to Joseph Desmond of BrightSource Energy and then to Mark Muro back in Washington, see if they have some responses. I noticed that you had something to say earlier, Joe.
Sure.
This is a very lively discussion, believe me.
No, I'm enjoying this very much. Jesse mentioned the technology that was used to get the fracking. And as an example, we're building these towers, and they're very high, and the temperatures exceed over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. We actually use the same sort of insulation that was developed for the space shuttle as it re-enters the atmosphere in order to be able to achieve those high temperatures in a safe manner and produce this energy cheaply. So that's just an example of R&D investment in one area being applied in this other technology, all of which contributes to helping drive the cost down over time.
Hang on a second, Mark, but it seems like the public response or impression is that, in fact, according to Robert, who sent us this, why are we jerking the support of clean energy after less than a decade of help? Could it be elected officials making the policies heavily invested and or financially supported by the oil companies? In other words, they have their impressions about who cares about what and why they're doing it, and it all seems to be self-interest. Mark, I hear you. Join us, please.
A little paranoia is probably justifiable and understandable. I'm going to take a somewhat more optimistic view based on, you know, the sheer variation and pervasiveness of now clean tech in you know, hundreds of U.S. metropolitan areas in dozens of vibrant regional economies from, you know, not only Boston and San Francisco, but, you know, through the South, you know, in Tennessee regions, Texas regions. There's now an on-the-ground, growing, vibrant, innovative set of industries that's in every member's backyard. So I think I think it's going to it strains credulity to think that in the end, members in Congress are simply going to walk away from these industries. I think we may have some surprises. The question is there the bandwidth and the sense of goodwill and pragmatism, and I would add technology literacy, to do the kind of redesign of these programs to ensure that they have longer lead times, that they do continue to evoke innovation and price competitiveness, but without this endless start and stop, extremely disruptive nature. So we're getting to these long timelines that we're talking about that are needed. So I'm just going to hold out a little bit of room for possible surprises and some pragmatism back here.
Pull up the optimism, put aside the cynicism. Is that what we're talking about? Jesse Jenkins, yeah, from the Breakthrough Institute. California has been always a leader, and Silicon Valley fancies itself one of those in these new technologies. But do they need the feds behind them in order to make, particularly in this economic climate with all these cuts and, you know?
Yeah, I think that they, you know, the state has been a leader, and Joe played a role in this when he was at the Energy Commission in developing policies that could at the state here that could help kickstart growth of these industries in California, make California a leader in the country and even in the world in the development of solar and wind and other technologies. And in many ways, those policies are great models for federal policymakers to look at right now. The California Solar Initiative, which provided about a 10-year period of support for rooftop solar to try to get thousands of installations up on rooftops across California in each of the three major utilities in the state's service territories, is a really great model of what Mark's talking about, which is the sort of long-term certainty. You've got a 10-year horizon of policy, but that one that steadily steps down in the price that we provide, the incentives we provide for solar installations as solar scales up in the state. So that was divided into 10 stages that as the industry grew, you would go through each of those steps, and the price that we would offer as a rebate would come down. So it's fallen from about $2.50 per watt as a rebate for people to put solar panels on their roof. Now we're down to 35 cents or less per watt in that incentive. So this is a great example of, as the industry grows, as prices mature, improve, as firms innovate and drive down costs, we can withdraw steadily the support we provide. So we both provide a window that of 10 years that industry can plan for, can invest in, and we also reduce the taxpayer impact of that over time and ultimately fade that support out entirely.
You know, it's interesting in this economic dance that while, as you say, costs are coming down, there are a lot of consumers out there that feel that they're not ready now to do this, that they're economically uncertain. And so there's this misstep going on as well. Let's check in with, on the telephone, Ross calling in from Houston, Texas, with his own big Texas perspective. Ross?
Hi, yeah, thanks. I think sometimes Texas gets a bad rap on energy. A lot of people probably don't know that Texas produces more wind energy than any other state in the nation, and there's a real progressive, high-tech attitude in this part of the world. But I think what a lot of people miss in this debate is the incredible efficiency of burning fossil fuels to produce and try to quench the thirst for an ever-increasing energy demand. And the fact that it's cleaner, the comments earlier about, you know, coal not doing so well these days, mainly it's because natural gas, the boom, the availability and the inexpensive nature of that fuel and the abundance is just a huge dynamic shift in our economy right now. And it works against mostly solar, but clean tech to a major degree. But it is a cleaner fuel. It's a lot cleaner, 50% cleaner than burning gasoline. So would love to just get that on the table. I think the efficiency of fossil fuel is just never talked about very much, and it's hard to compete with solar and wind against its efficiency.
Jesse?
Yeah, and I think just to point out again that the shale gas revolution that has really changed energy markets in the United States and unlocked a really affordable domestic source of energy was again catalyzed by over two decades of federal support for technology development, for some of the key technologies that enabled shale gas extraction, and an unconventional gas tax credit that helped get that industry and those extraction techniques off the ground for it was in place for over 22 years. So again, I think this is actually a model of what could happen if we can make the right supports for technology innovation and industry growth in the clean tech sector over the next decade. As the caller pointed out, natural gas is a cleaner form of energy than coal. It's now very affordable, and we have we expanded America's supplies of energy. I think that we can do the same with wind, with solar, with biofuels, with electric vehicles, which will enhance America's energy security. It'll create new growth sectors, like natural gas is now adding lots of jobs. We can do that in other sectors as well, but it's going to require the same kind of catalytic federal support. And unfortunately, that support is currently scheduled to phase down or really drop off a cliff in the next couple of years. And instead, I think we need the same kind of measured approach to driving technology innovation and driving down costs that really helped enable the shale gas revolution. I think, again, this is a message that can resonate with Republicans and others who recognize that this is about cleaner energy, but it's also about more domestic energy, and it's about greater energy security. And natural gas is a great boon to the country for our energy security now, but it's not sufficient. Those supplies will dwindle, and they can only supply so much of our energy. We need other sources as well. We need a diverse, secure energy sources for this country, and clean energy is a key part of that.
I've got less than 45 seconds. I would imagine that part of what is really important here is you need the public to weigh in. Joseph Desmond, in 10 seconds, where do they weigh in and how do they
engagement,
weigh in?
Contact your congressman, your senator. Let them know you care about clean energy. You care about all forms of energy, but that it's necessary to continue to support these industries.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all of our guests, and sorry to the folks still waiting on the phone. We appreciate your calling in. Mark Muro, Senior Fellow Policy Director, Metropolitan Policy Program of the Brookings Institution. Jesse Jenkins, Director of Energy and Climate Policy, the Breakthrough Institute in Oakland. Joseph Desmond, Senior Vice President, Government Affairs and Communications for Bright Source Energy of Oakland. And Fred Lucero, Program Manager for Richmond Build Academy.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.